Scott Morrison, thanks for your time.
Good to be with you, Brian. Good
evening. Look, I know you don't worry too much about the polls, but you are falling behind.
We don't worry too much about the polls, Brian, but I would expect the polls to improve anyway as these new proposed company tax cuts kick in.
Yeah, and I read this week that the company tax cuts have passed this pub test.
Oh, yes, a ringing endorsement this week in the pub test, Brian.
How do you determine what passes the pub test?
Well, Malcolm Turnbull and I went to a pub, Brian, and we sought people's views. We said, what is your view of these proposed company tax cuts?
Who'd you ask?
Myself personally?
Yeah.
I asked Malcolm, Brian.
And who did Malcolm ask?
He asked me.
Hello, this is The Money. I'm Richard Adey. Today, we'll look at the idea of cutting the corporate tax rate. On Tuesday evening, the Treasurer, Scott Morrison, produced the budget. But the government's been trying to change the corporate tax rate for months. At the moment, they're a couple of votes short in the Senate. Small businesses are already getting a tax break. If your turnover's less than $10 million a year, you pay 27.5% rather than 30%. From next financial year, bigger firms with a turnover of up to $50 million will get the same deal. Larger than that, though, and it's 30%. The government wants to drop it to 25% for all companies by 2026-27. Professor Beth Webster's an economist at Swinburne University.
If taxes are cut, the argument is there'll be more investment that will lead to more jobs and maybe a higher productivity, that is, output per worker in businesses. Now, there's two forces going on here when you cut company tax. One is what they call the supply side, and that's when, as a result of cutting the company tax rate from 30 to 25%, businesses keep more of their profits in the form of retained earnings. And the argument here is that they retain, you know, more earnings, obviously, and then that makes it easier for them to invest because they don't have to go and convince a banker or go and convince the stock market to lend them money or to buy their shares. They just have to convince themselves that this investment's a great idea and they go on and do it. And a lot of economic studies have tried to measure this, and on balance, half of them find yes, half of them find no. It does lead to more investment. Cutting a corporate tax rate does lead to more investment. But what I would say is it depends very much on the context, that is, where the economy is at the current time as to whether or not cutting the tax rate will stimulate investment. Now, in Australia in 2018, we have historically high profit levels, that is, the share of gross income going to profits rather than to wages and salaries is historically high. And we also have very, very low interest rates. So if you do go to the bank to borrow, you're paying a very cheap price for the money. So businesses aren't constrained on the have we got funds to invest side in particular, in general. You know, specific ones might be. But in general, profit shares high, interest rates are at a historic low. So it's unlikely that people are putting off a lot of investments because they can't get the funds to fund it.
So on the supply side, it won't make much difference.
The other reason why corporate tax cuts might stimulate investment is on what's called the demand side, which is how much will people buy what you produce? If you're going to go out and invest and expand the size of your business, employ more people, you're going to produce more goods and services. And you're not going to do that unless you're fairly confident you can sell them. No one spends all that money producing things if they don't think there's a market for it. Now, how would a corporate tax cut encourage people to buy more goods and services, that is, householders? And that's a sort of a hard one to argue again too.
In many countries, the arguing would be easier. Lower corporate tax means higher profits. Higher profits mean higher dividends. Happy days. But Danielle Wood, who's at the Grattan Institute, says here it's not so simple because of dividend imputation.
It's a strange beast, really. There's not many countries that have fully fledged dividend imputation like Australia. And what it means is that companies tax is essentially a withholding tax. So companies pay taxes on their profits. They then distribute dividends to shareholders. Those dividends have franking credits attached, and that recognises the fact that companies have paid profits on those dividends. So in the investors' hands, people receive tax credits for the tax the company has already paid. So that reduces their personal tax bill by the amount of the franking credits.
So if your marginal tax rate's 45% and you receive dividend payments, the franking credits mean that because you've already been taxed at 30%, you only have to pay the difference in your tax, so 15%. If company tax goes down to 25%, you're paying a bigger difference, 20%. You don't really get a benefit, which means you don't have extra to buy more shares or more anything. But most people probably don't own shares directly. What about households that aren't getting income from dividends? Beth Webster.
It really depends on when, if the government suffers a drop in tax receipts, and that mightn't be huge because of that franking thing, whether they compensate by increasing taxes elsewhere or they cut back on government spending. Now, if they cut back on government spending, then say they cut back on spending on hospitals, well, that's going to lead to fewer nurses, fewer doctors, fewer orderlies, and the demand by those people, their incomes go down, they can buy fewer goods and services, and so therefore that's going to undermine investment. So if you have a corporate tax cut, you've got to make sure the government keeps its spending at the same level. It doesn't cut back as well, because otherwise you're going to undermine that whole theory of corporate tax cuts stimulate investment, because they'll undermine the market for goods and services.
Independent economist Saul Eslake says there's something else as well.
Secondly, and perhaps more importantly, economic theories, however elegant they are and how persuasive they sound, don't always play out in practice, or if they do, they don't always play out in a materially significant way. And over the last 3 years, I've struggled to find compelling evidence from those countries who have cut their corporate tax rates by big margins that the theoretical effects that economists expect actually play out in a significant or measurable way at all. And even the government's own modelling suggests that the impact of the tax cut which they propose on economic activity, on employment, on wages, is pretty small over a very long period of time compared with the cost to revenue of the tax cut which they propose.
So it's problematic on the supply side and on the demand side, and it may not work out as neatly as Treasury imagines. Peter Swan goes further. The Professor of Finance at the Business School in the University of New South Wales made a submission to the Senate committee arguing against a corporate tax cut.
Because I feel that it's going to be very costly to individual taxpayers. They're going to have to make up for the very substantial loss in tax revenue as taxes are reduced to foreign investors and to foreigners or foreign shareholders, essentially. And since Australians don't pay any corporate tax as such, these tax cuts are of no benefit to them. So the argument for a corporate tax cut must be that it will not only increase investment and perhaps indirectly raise wages, but it must do so by a huge amount to justify the cost to revenue, which the government estimates to be around $65 billion over the next decade.
He's really not convinced.
It's going to cost ordinary people in the street. It's going to potentially cost them somewhere between $8 and $13 billion a year in additional tax, personal tax, of one form or another.
I think the government's talking about an addition to GDP over that 10 years of 1%. At a cost of $65 billion. Now, to me, that doesn't sound like a very good deal, but why is it not a good deal?
Well, firstly, even on the most optimistic projections, it's nothing like even the miserly 1%. It's more like a quarter of 1%, and even that's on the most favourable projections or simulations. And that would be accompanied, actually, by a fall in employment, not an increase in employment.
On the money, we're looking at the idea of cutting the corporate tax rate. What about other countries? What's happened overseas? Saul Eslake.
Well, Canada's an instructive example, in my view, because for a whole lot of ways, there's no country on earth that's more like Australia in terms of the way it ticks than Canada. We're more resource intensive than they are, but we're both mining economies, energy economies. We have a very similar federal system. Our populations are strung out around the fringe of a largely empty landmass in much the same way. Our financial and media systems are very similar as well. well. Canada cut its corporate tax rate from about 41% in 2000 to 26% by 2011. That is a cut of about 15 percentage points, three times as much as the Turnbull government is proposing to cut Australia's company tax rate. During that time, Australia cut its company tax rate by 4 percentage points in 2001, following the recommendations of the Ralph Review of Business Taxation. But despite Canada having cut its tax rate by 15 percentage points over that interval, Australia has actually seen a bigger increase from 2001 through 2017 in investment as a share of GDP. That's, of course, after the passing of the mining boom, which was bigger here than in Canada. But we got more investment into our mining sector despite having a higher tax rate than Canada through that period. And real wages have increased over that 17-year period by about 20% more in Australia than they have done in Canada over that period of time.
Another country that gets mentioned by supporters of the cut is Britain.
The UK is, of course, a very different economy. It's much more services-driven than we are, but nonetheless, they have cut their company tax rate from 28% in 2000 to 17%, I think it is, as of 2017. It was a staggered cut of 1 or 2 percentage points per annum over a period of time. And there's no evidence at all that that's led to an increase in business investment, to higher productivity, or to an increase in real wages in the UK, which, again, isn't very compelling evidence to support the proposition that all of those consequences would flow from what the Turnbull government wants to do.
What about America?
The government likes to point to the cuts in corporate tax that the Trump administration has just enacted as an argument for doing something similar in Australia. And certainly since those tax cuts were enacted in the United States, forecasters have been revising up their expectations for growth in the US economy. But as the International Monetary Fund pointed out in its most recent World Economic Outlook, where they revised up their forecasts for the US economy by quite a noticeable margin, the part of the Trump administration's tax package that is driving that increase in the short-term economic growth outlook for the United States is not the cut in the corporate tax rate or the cut in the personal income tax rate. It's the American version of what we in Australia would call an instant asset write-off. That is a provision allowing large companies to deduct from their income for tax purposes the entirety of their capital expenditures rather than having to depreciate it over time. Now, that's a temporary measure, obviously, and the IMF notes that there will be some payback for the bring forward of investment further down the track. But an instant asset write-off is not part of what the Turnbull government is offering here. 'Cause I'm the tax man.
One of the reasons for cutting the corporate tax rate is to attract more foreign investment. This is money that could go anywhere, and we want more of it to come here. Be thankful I don't take it all. Danielle Wood from the Grattan Institute.
Well, our research draws on modelling from a range of groups, including the Federal Treasury and other organisations that have done modelling for the Treasury. And that suggests if you reduce company taxes, you will get an increase in foreign investment. That's because if you reduce the tax rate, you increase after-tax returns on investment, and therefore capital, being internationally mobile in a lot of cases, will undertake more projects in Australia as a result of that reduction in the tax rate.
But how important is the tax rate to a foreign investor?
They're just one factor in the broader range of things that investors are going to be taking into account. So they'll be looking at things like how stable is the government and the institutions, how educated is the workforce, how functional are the cities, you know, what are the natural resources, particularly for mining investment, that's going to be a really important part of the equation. So tax rates are certainly a factor in decisions of where capital will be allocated across the world, but they're only one factor.
As you say all those things, and I'm sure there's actually dozens and dozens of things that are considered, I'm thinking Australia's kicking goals in most of those areas. I mean, we must be one of the more attractive places to invest anyway.
That's exactly right. And I think all the research shows that if you look at the places that are attractive, for foreign investors because of all those factors that we've talked about, they do tend to have higher company tax rates than places that don't have quite so much to offer. So, you know, the tax havens, for example, are often, you know, small countries without natural resources. They compete via having a very low company tax rate. Places that have a lot more to offer foreign companies can keep their company tax rate a bit higher and still attract reasonable levels of investment.
But the tax rate's only a factor you have to consider if you're paying it. Peter Swan from the University of New South Wales says many foreign investors aren't.
Well, I wouldn't say all corporate investors are not paying tax. I would say that the way portfolio investment, which does make up a sizable but not by far from the entire amount of foreign investment in Australia, on portfolio investment, that is, say, shareholders in the ASX-listed arm of BHP, for example, and many of these would be foreigners, they effectively pay little or no corporate tax either. And before 1997, this came about because they could simply sell their shares a day before the stock went ex-dividend, sell it to an Australian who could benefit from the tax rebate, and then purchase it back the next day. In 1997, the Treasury and the government intervened to reduce the benefits from this by requiring that the Australian hold it for 45 days prior to being able to claim this rebate. And I believe this simply pushes back the day at which they have to sell their shares by about 47 days.
This hinges on dividend imputation.
Dividends are paid in Australia every 6 months. The major Australian companies that pay tax here issue so-called franked dividends. And when those dividends are paid out, those shareholders essentially receive a rebate for the value of the tax paid on their behalf. But I have shown through my analysis that these rebates are priced. They depress the return going to Australian investors. So when they receive the franked dividend, this actually costs them something in the returns that they actually get. So I would say that these franked dividends are mostly priced in the Australian market.
Essentially, a foreign investor can sell for a good price, wait 7 weeks, and then buy the shares again, neatly avoiding tax in the process.
So when the foreigner sells the shares before they go ex-dividend, they get a high price reflecting the value of the dividend and the franking credit before it goes to the Australian who can claim credit for it. So the foreigner gets a capital gain, essentially, when they sell it, and they can then buy it back at a cheaper price because it's now bought back without the dividend and without the franking credit.
What goes up must come down. This is The Money on RN, the ABC Listen app, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Adie. Today, we're looking at the proposed cut to the corporate tax rate. Painted pony, let the spinning wheel spin. You got no money and you got no home. The government says a lower tax will push up incomes. But how much? Danielle Wood from the Grattan Institute.
There's certainly models that kind of give you that answer, but the models differ according to the assumptions that are made. So models that are run for the Treasury suggests that if we reduce the company tax rate from 30 to 25, as the government is proposing, in the long run, that will increase national incomes, so the total incomes of Australians, by about 0.5 or 0.6%. So there'll be some positive impact in the long run on everyone's well-being. There are other models that make slightly different assumptions that suggest that because of the cost of the tax cuts to the budget, overall national incomes will go backwards as a result of this cut. That suggests to me that we're probably somewhere near the sweet spot at the moment, but it's very difficult to know that, you know, bringing it down a little bit, what the impact will be on overall well-being of Australians.
So, not a lot of income growth, not a lot of foreign investment. Peter Swan.
There might be some marginal direct investment projects which will now be viable that weren't before, but these effects, are likely to be small. So I wouldn't say none. I would say that these effects are likely to be very small.
Why do you think the government is pursuing this? So many people who are experts seem not to be convinced of it.
I can only conjecture that the government hopes to get lots of support, financial and otherwise, from the big corporates who are very keen that these changes go through. I don't see Australia as a whole getting a huge benefit when you consider that the costs of this probably marginal increase in investment are likely to be swamped by the additional personal taxes, which are going to be very substantial to balance the budget. So Australians as a whole are going to be a lot worse off, according to nearly all the analysis I have seen.
The Business Council has been lobbying for the tax cut and reportedly will begin campaigning for it. Saul Eslake has some advice.
I've been saying on and off for 20 years that business people would be far more persuasive advocates for cuts in the company tax rate if they were more able than they have been to separate out the interests they have as people running large companies from the interests they have as high income earners. So if, for example, the business community were prepared to say, yes, there should be a cut in the company tax rate, but we also ought to look at some of the things that highly paid executives do to reduce the amount of personal income tax that they pay, such as the use of trusts or negative gearing or generous superannuation concessions and the like, that if they were prepared to put those into the mix in order to propose reforms that could be sold and reasonably sold as being more equitable, improving the efficiency of the economy, patterns of resource allocation, just simply being fair, then I think those arguments would fall on more fertile ground than they have done up to this point.
It's not an easy sell, and it shouldn't be. The experts, once you filter out the low-tax ideologues and the big business cheerleaders, are mostly not convinced. Is it worth doing?
I think that's a question on which reasonable minds can differ. So if you think that boosting incomes by a small amount, an uncertain amount, well into the future, is worth the significant upfront and budgetary cost today, some people may conclude that is worth doing. My personal view is that given the state of the budget, given the fact that those benefits are a long way down the track and that we can't even be sure about how large they are, I don't think that is the policy that the government should be pursuing at this point in time.
So what should we be doing to get better economic outcomes? Danielle Woods.
There are alternatives to a company tax cut to stimulate investment, and that would be things like accelerated depreciation or investment allowances. Those are things that reward firms for making investments today and give them effectively a tax break on undertaking new investments. Those are cheaper than a company tax cut for a given level of new investment, and that's because they're not giving a free kick to existing investments that have already taken place. So when you cut taxes on companies, not only are you giving them a lower tax rate on new investments, they're actually now getting a lower tax rate on profits that they're making from things they've already done. So that's why company tax cuts are pretty expensive.
Beth Webster is thinking bigger.
If you really want to encourage investment and encourage the growth of employment, more jobs, there are probably better ways, more direct ways to do it. You know, having a stimulatory budget, for example, that I don't believe there's anything wrong with having ongoing budgetary deficits. We had ongoing budgetary deficits for decades after World War II, and they were the halcyon days. They were the days of 1% to 2% unemployment and low inflation. So if you really want to stimulate investment, you can do that. You can stimulate exports. There are a lot of excellent export programs out there, trade missions, for example, that have been shown to have a fantastic effect on the ability of Australians to sell overseas. Because for us, to sell export is not like living in the middle of Europe where you just drive a truck over the border. It is quite a big step change in terms of getting on the plane, going and winning the confidence of people you're selling your products to. So there's a lot that can be done in terms of stimulating our economy, certainly on that export side. So if you seriously want to stimulate the growth of the economy and get rid of that, you know, what is 700,000 unemployed people plus maybe 700,000 more who are hidden unemployed, I would say that's probably the way to go.
So Beth, if we didn't have the tax cuts and you had that $65 billion to boost the economy, what would you do with it?
I think I would obviously fully fund programs like the national disability insurance scheme that go to people who are on low incomes or the most needy, their spending is going to have a massive stimulatory effect on the economy. I think there's a lot that can be done, certainly in the education sector, certainly around vocational education, which has really taken a back seat in the last 10 years. So in terms of boosting programs and bringing us up to the frontier in terms of education and training standards, we know we're not at it, especially in the vet area.
Peter Swan has a very different suggestion.
The best thing we can do, actually, is to move away from the Paris Accord and allow energy markets to work. I believe this would encourage more relatively clean fossil fuel investment, which will undo some of the massive increases in energy prices, electricity prices that we've seen. We've seen the doubling of electricity prices in the last few years. There may be yet another doubling again. And under these circumstances, I'm not surprised to see from the Business Council figures that the level of investment as a percentage of GDP has fallen from about 18% to about 14% or less since 2012.
These are one-off ideas, but that's what tax changes usually are. We had the Henry Review, which outlined major reforms, and we didn't use it. Daniel Wood.
I think we are very much in the world of piecemeal tax reform at the moment, if you can even call it tax reform. I think it's a real disappointment that we had this fantastic review, as you said, conducted by Ken Henry. There was a huge number of recommendations as part of that. None of those have been taken up by either side of politics. So I would absolutely strongly support a more wholesale tax reform. And even if we look at the Henry Tax Review, what was said about company tax cuts there was, yes, it might be ideal to bring company tax rates down over time, but you do that as part of a broader package. For example, looking at things like taxation of resource rents so that the impact on the budget wouldn't be so large. You'd be changing the tax mix rather than just focusing on cutting this one particular tax.
The experts you've heard from today clearly aren't convinced that cutting the corporate tax rate is a good idea. But it isn't their opinion that matters.
Well, it hinges on a couple of independent senators at the moment. Darren Hinch and Tim Storer really have the fate of this package in their hands. I think the comments that Tim Storer has made in particular have been very thoughtful. I appeared at a Senate committee last week on this topic, and he was one of the senators sitting on that committee, and he's very engaged with the issues. He sort of wants to understand the modelling, and he's clearly going to sort of think the issue through in a lot of detail. So it's difficult to know which way both of those senators will end up going, but I think it's a positive that they're doing it on the merits of the issue, and they're I think they're clearly thinking about, you know, what's going to be the right answer for Australia's economy and for Australians.
Daniel Wood is the Program Director of Budget Policy and Institutional Reform at the Grattan Institute. You also heard from Professor Peter Swan from the Business School at the University of New South Wales, Professor Beth Webster, Director of the Centre for Transformative Innovation at Swinburne University, and Saul Eslake, Independent Economist and Vice-Chancellor's Fellow at the University of Tasmania. Thanks to all of them. The Money is produced by Kate Piercy. Our sound engineer is Judy Rapley. I'm Richard Adie.